EWTN News In-Depth correspondent Colin Flynn travels the globe and follows the path of the Pope's upcoming trip to Southeast Asia.
Where we'll be learning about how the Church is trying to strengthen the bonds between Christianity and Islam.
Analysis of the mission and spirit of this challenging papal journey. As presidential nominees Donald Trump and Kamala Harris continue on the campaign trail through battleground states, candidate Harris does that first sit-down interview answering tough questions.
This November, abortion is on the ballot in states across America. I'm Mark Irons with a report from Florida coming up.
And just as important to some voters as the presidential election, we take a deep dive into abortion ballot initiatives across the country. EWTN News in Depth starts now.
Abortion is not a right, it's a wrong. It's a huge wrong.
The Archbishop of Miami weighs in with the Catholic response to Florida Amendment 4, an attempt in this fall's November election to change the state constitution to allow for abortion through fetal viability and beyond. Welcome to EWTN News in Depth. I'm Catherine Hadrow. When the U.S. Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade more than two summers ago, it shifted the abortion debate to the states. Ballot initiatives, which allow voters to shape their state's abortion laws, have become the latest front in the battle for life. And this November, a record 10 states will vote on abortion. This map from Catholic News Agency and EWTN Pro-Life Weekly shows where abortion is on the ballot. States in yellow will vote on whether to amend their state constitutions to include a so-called right to abortion. Arizona, Colorado, Florida, Maryland, Missouri, Montana, Nebraska, Nevada, New York, and South Dakota. Nebraska will also vote on a second ballot initiative, which would add a 12-week abortion limit to the state's constitution. These ballot initiatives follow numerous consecutive losses for the pro-life movement at the polls. The first one in Kansas. The Value Them Both amendment sought to reverse the state's so-called constitutional right to abortion and allow lawmakers to pass pro-life laws. Many viewed the vote as a litmus test for future abortion measures. And in August of 2022, Kansas voters rejected the pro-life amendment. It was the first significant loss for the pro-life movement after its major victory in the overturning of Roe v. Wade. Since then, pro-life Americans have seen five more losses for life at the ballot box. California, Michigan, Ohio, and Vermont all amended their constitutions to include a so-called right to abortion. In Kentucky, a traditionally red state with strong pro-life laws, voters rejected an initiative that would have amended the state constitution to say there is no right to abortion. With 10 states taking up abortion this November, pro-life advocates see another uphill battle to protect the unborn. But some are looking to Florida as an opportunity to flip the script on abortion amendments and land a significant win in the post-Roe landscape. Mark Irons takes us to the Sunshine State and shows how the Catholic Church is working to defend life.
Abortion will be on a number of state ballots this November, and one consequential amendment will be decided in Florida.
I think people should have the right to do an abortion whenever they choose.
I think you're killing an innocent human.
We spoke to voters throughout South Florida. If Amendment 4 passes in November, it would remove the state's current ban on abortion after 6 weeks of pregnancy, and an unborn child could be aborted much later during his or her development. The proposed state constitutional amendment reads in part, "No law shall prohibit, penalize, delay, or restrict abortion before viability or when necessary to protect the patient's health, as determined by the patient's health care provider."
I mean, that kind of takes rights away from the child, which is unborn.
Justin Navarez of Lake Worth, Florida, is critical of Amendment 4 and will vote against it.
I will vote no. Yes, I will vote no.
In Miami, Isabella Davila voiced her support for abortion.
Everyone here should have the right to, you know, decide what's happening with their body.
It's their body, you know, their body, their choice.
But in Palm Beach, Abigail Michael is pushing back against that type of description of the issue.
I don't think it's really my body, my choice, because there is another human in there.
In South Florida, Archbishop Thomas Winski of Miami provides the voice of the Catholic Church. which he adds respects the view of science that life begins at conception. And his pro-life message isn't just for Catholics throughout the state.
Abortion is not a religious issue, it's a human rights issue.
What does the state of Florida need to know about Amendment 4?
Well, it's a very radical amendment, and so what they need to know is to vote no on 4.
60% of Florida voters would have to vote yes on Amendment 4 for the measure to pass. Republican Governor Ron DeSantis, who signed the ban on abortion after 6 weeks, has warned the passage of Amendment 4 would mean the end of the pro-life movement in Florida.
To eliminate all pro-life protections, parental consent for abortion, and have abortion all the way up to the moment of birth. Now, that is wrong.
In the Sunshine State, abortion law will be decided by the people.
We brought that issue back to the states, and now the states are voting on it.
Many are wondering how one well-known Floridian will vote on the amendment. Donald Trump's Mar-a-Lago residence is across the water here in Palm Beach, Florida. The former president says abortion is an issue that each state should decide on. And Thursday, during an NBC News interview, Trump was asked how he would vote on Amendment 4.
There's an abortion-related amendment on the ballot to overturn the 6-week ban in Florida. How are you going to vote on that?
Well, I think the 6-week is too short. It has to be more time, and so and I've told them that I want more weeks.
So you'll vote in favor of the amendment?
I am going to be voting that we need more than 6 weeks.
Soon after that, his campaign released a statement saying President Trump has not yet said how he will vote on the ballot initiative in Florida. He simply reiterated that he believes 6 weeks is too short. Deanna Mimoni, a Trump supporter from Delray Beach, hopes even those who think abortion should be allowed at certain times during pregnancy will object to unrestricted abortion access.
I do believe that women have the right to choose, but I also think there has to be a limit to that choice. Amendment 4, no. I'm voting no on Amendment 4.
The Archdiocese of Miami has rolled out a comprehensive campaign asking voters to do the same.
Vote no on Amendment 4.
By eliminating parental consent, Amendment 4 would make abortion the only procedure, the only medical procedure that a minor child can access in Florida.
It's ambiguous. It's deceptive.
To leave viability undefined gives complete freedom for elective abortion through the entire pregnancy.
And Archbishop Winsky says if people are looking for more reasons to vote no on the amendment.
I told them that last year in the state, 80,000 abortions took place. And that those are 80,000 reasons why we should vote against 4 in November.
Mark Irons, EWTN News in depth.
To get a sense of the full picture of what is happening across the country on the ballot initiative front, we are joined by Sue Liebel of Susan B. Anthony Pro-Life America. Sue has a national overview as the organization's state affairs director. She also serves a dual role as its Midwest regional director. Sue, welcome. It's great to speak with you. I first want to get your take on Florida. Some pro-lifers believe Florida could become the first state to defeat an abortion amendment. What are your thoughts?
I think that's entirely possible. Don't give up hope. Stay in the game. Amendment 4 is so deceptive and so extreme that those facts have come out early and often. Governor DeSantis has been an incredible voice to get that message out so that the lies and the deception won't be believed. We've seen that, unfortunately, in other states. But in Florida, Floridians are getting the truth. And they're getting it early. It is abortion up until birth. It is too extreme for Florida. Even President Trump opposes, you're not sure where he's at, but we know he opposes abortion after 5 months. And this amendment would go way past that. So we think Florida has is a beacon of hope.
You mentioned Governor DeSantis. Can you speak more about the role he's been playing in the state's pro-life momentum? And would you like to see more action from other states' pro-life governors and leaders?
Absolutely. I think he's just being a role model in all of this because, you know, Hollywood and the media, the mainstream media, the liberal bastions of abortion are all out there. It's hard to get the truth out there sometimes, but our elected officials who have that bully pulpit and will use it can get that message out and help voters understand what the question actually says, what that actually means. and how to vote. So I think that Governor DeSantis has really led the way. And I know I'm talking with other states and other governors about doing the same.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned how former President Donald Trump has expressed he is against late-term abortion. But are you concerned that his comments this week that Florida's current six-week abortion ban is too short? Are you concerned that might sway voters to end up supporting Amendment 4?
Well, I certainly hope not, because while I'm against abortion at any stage, there's a huge difference between Florida's existing abortion law and abortion all the way up until birth. That's such a huge gap. And so what Floridians need to understand is that this amendment would take abortion all the way up until birth, which some people don't believe actually happens,
right,
but it does. So it's really true. It would also make it to throw women under the bus, make it so that the health and safety standards won't apply, that it won't even have to be a doctor that does the abortion, and most importantly, too, take away parental rights so that parents won't have any rights in their child abortion. All the stuff you talked about leading up to this interview that I was listening to, it's all true.
Yeah. Sue, what about other states with abortion on the ballot? 10 states, you know, will be voting on this November. How are you feeling about that?
We are always concerned because of the experience of other states, of how much money the other side spends. For example, in Ohio last November, they spent $60 million. Overall, in the past, six states have passed up, they've $2.5 million they spend. They have an unlimited amount of money. Unfortunately, they spend that to put TV commercials on that say women won't get health care. That's not true. They put on TV commercials that make you think that if you don't vote yes, you know, the world's going to. It's not true. All 50 states have laws that allow health care for women. No one's going to do that. So we have learned a little bit about how the other side plays dirty. And it's hard to combat that, but we will. We do. And I, as you see, lots of players in Florida already in the game. Already speaking out, men, women, religious leaders, others. And it's really, really important that we do that, and we do that often, so we help people understand and not believe what they're going to be seeing on TV.
Absolutely. Just expanding on that point, as someone who has been steeped in the pro-life movement, Sue, for years, what is your big picture prognosis as to why the life issue is consecutively losing on the state level since Dobbs?
Well, unfortunately, as I said, the other side has an unlimited amount of resources to confuse and lie to viewers or radio listeners or wherever you're getting their messaging. It's just not true. In fact, they say that this is not that extreme, but the states that have already done it, Michigan and Ohio, they've already started then. They passed theirs, and now they're taking away all the health and safety protections for women. And it's shocking what's happening once it passed. And people are saying, oh, wait, I didn't mean that. I didn't mean that extreme. Mm-hmm. And so we want to, we know that we're up against a formidable opponent. And of course, we are on the side of truth. Mm-hmm. And that's something that makes us have to talk about this every day. My recommendation, mm-hmm, to your viewers is to discern what you're hearing. If you hear that TV ad or that radio ad that says that women aren't going to get the health care they need, I mean, really? Is that really going to happen? Mm-hmm. Of course not. Mm-hmm. So we need to be discerning probably more than we've seen in most modern times.
There's also
a trans aspect to this, and I hope that someday you'll talk about this on your show too.
But to that point, we all need to have our critical thinking caps on amid all this campaign messaging. Sue, there's a debate even among pro-lifers about the federal government's role in protecting life. For example, mm-hmm, whether there should even be a federal abortion ban. Given this political moment that we're in, can you speak to the importance of the state and the state's role in defending life right now?
Oh, absolutely. The state, in fact, what we're talking about here with the amendment is amending the state's constitution. Not just the law, the actual constitution itself of Florida or Missouri or or Arizona mm-hmm. or other states. So that's really going to the very foundational documents that we have, are our state constitutions. States are closest to the voter. So think about your state representative. Find out who your state representative is, your state senator, your governor. That's very, very important now for abortion policy. States will play a much greater role now. And you've seen it in Florida. Mm-hmm. They had a heartbeat bill, but then they had a 15-week bill, excuse me, and then they went ahead and passed the heartbeat bill later when they had the opportunity to do after Dobbs. And so, and of course, Governor DeSantis is speaking out and is being a leader in Florida. So it's really important at the state level. We also believe, though, I just really need to say that we do believe that there is still a federal role. For example, most countries, we're one of the very few countries mm-hmm. that don't have some sort of limit. I'm not saying ban, but I'm saying maybe a limit when a baby can feel mm-hmm. pain, or a first trimester yep. limit, or take your pick.
Absolutely.
But most countries have that. Most countries have that.
And people need to know about that and, you know, how extreme it is. Sue Liebel, we are so grateful for the national perspective that you bring. Thank you.
Thank you.
Our reporting today on ballot initiatives across the country is just the beginning of much more information we will be bringing to EWTN News viewers on this issue. In the coming weeks, our sister broadcast, EWTN Pro-Life Weekly, will provide state-by-state coverage of the ballot initiatives, including those states trying to remove newly instituted pro-life laws, and states like Maryland and New York, which want to add abortion-related protections to existing pro-abortion laws. That full extensive reporting on EWTN Pro-Life Weekly Thursday nights at 10 p.m. Eastern. We are just getting started on this edition of EWTN News in Depth. After the break, we are on the road, jetting to Asia to trace the route of the next big papal journey.
I'm Colin Flynn, and I'm sitting here in Dili, the capital of Timor-Leste, and beside me, I just happen to have the president of Timor-Leste. And coming up on the program, we'll be having a talk about how he feels about the upcoming visit of Pope Francis to his nation.
Next, we take you on a whirlwind overview of the four countries in Southeast Asia and Oceania, anticipating the arrival of Pope Francis in his most ambitious and demanding international trip ever. EWTN News in Depth is coming right back.
On Monday, Pope Francis departs for the most ambitious and demanding international trip of his papacy. Over 12 days and 20,000 miles, the Holy Father will travel to four countries in Southeast Asia and Oceania. Starting in Jakarta, Indonesia, Pope Francis will preside over Mass at a large football stadium and also lead an interfaith meeting. Indonesia has the world's largest Muslim population. The pontiff will then travel on to Papua New Guinea, East Timor, and conclude the visit in Singapore for the longest trip of his papacy. Cardinal Luis Antonio Tagle, pro-prefect of the Dicastery for Evangelization, helps explain the purpose of this trip, especially in light of the 87-year-old pontiff's physical ailments. The Vatican confirmed on Friday that Cardinal Tagle will be traveling with the pope during his journey. Quote, "I am younger than the pope, and these long journeys are heavy even for me. For him, embracing this effort is an act of humility, too. It's not a show to portray what one is still capable of. As a witness, I call it an act of humility before the Lord who calls us, an act of humility and obedience to the mission." To help us better understand the significance of this major papal trip, we are joined here on set by EWTN News editorial director, Dr. Matthew Bunsen. Thanks for being here. Matthew, first, can you put this trip into context for us, this massive scale? How significant is this travel?
It's an immensely significant trip. This is the 45th international trip of a pontificate that's now, 11 years old. But if we want to find a word to express this, it's microcosm. This trip is a microcosm of some of the major themes of this pontificate. If we start in Indonesia, for example, where Catholics make up about 3% of the population, Pope Francis has been emphasizing for a very long time throughout his pontificate, interreligious dialogue, in particular with Islam. We have an Indonesian government that is very focused on trying to maintain religious harmony. So Pope Francis is going to tap into that. When he moves to Papua New Guinea, where Catholics make up about 26% of the population, his theme there is going to be, again, harmony, but he's also going to be looking at some of the ecological issues, as well as the dangers of ideological colonization, of aid being attached to embracing ideas and concepts and things like abortion, contraception, and other things. When he moves then to East Timor, which is the most Catholic country in the world, 98% Catholic, it's, again, his focus on the environment, sustainability, eco-sustainability, and also dealing with economic disparities. Then he moves to Singapore, where you have one of the most rich and diverse cultures anywhere in Asia, anywhere in the world, really, with multiple religions, and there the key word's going to be fraternity.
So, like you said, microcosm, hitting on a lot of themes that we've heard throughout his papacy. And, Matthew, we know that our Holy Father has a slew of health issues. He's become more and more reliant on a wheelchair as of late. What kind of message does it send that he's taking this most ambitious trip amid his health problems and his age?
Yeah, the scale of it, to use your word again, is really something we need to focus on. This is the first international trip he's taken in a year. There were serious questions as to whether or not he would even make this trip, and yet here he is. He's making a point. I think there are a couple of them. First, he's still very much committed to the peripheries, to going out, to be this evangelist out in the world. But again, he's focusing on Asia. Asia has been of great importance to him. So he's also making a statement. All eyes are on China, as always, but looking at where the church is growing fastest. In Asia, you have 150 million Catholics. It's still a tiny percent of the population, but if we look at it as a factor of growth in the church, this is one of those key areas for the future of global Catholicism.
That is all such helpful context. And Matthew, stay with us as we take our viewers now to a journey to all four countries Pope Francis will be visiting to get a sense of the religious life there. Correspondent Colin Flynn has been on the road. His first stop is Indonesia.
Here in Indonesia, there are 29 million Christians. Now that sounds impressive until you compare it to the number of Muslims, 242 million. My name is Colm Flynn, and I'm here in Jakarta, where Pope Francis will start his visit to Southeast Asia, meeting Muslim leaders here to strengthen the relationship between the two religions. Then he will fly 7,000 miles here to the city of Port Moresby in Papua New Guinea to see firsthand the work the church is doing to help those on the margins. Next up, one of the youngest countries in the world, East Timor, where the Pope will meet the President to hear how their country is forging a new path. And finally, Pope Francis will land here in Singapore, where he will celebrate Mass with up to 50,000 people. Well, to try and get a better understanding of why the Pope is visiting these countries, we've decided to travel to all four. This is Pope Francis in Southeast Asia. When Pope Francis announced he was embarking on this journey, the longest trip of his papacy, many were shocked. At 87 years of age, using a wheelchair, and with recent health scares, for the Holy Father, this will be a great challenge. It's also a challenge for the hosting countries. The last time Indonesia welcomed a pope was John Paul II in 1989. In the Indonesian capital, Jakarta, at Our Lady of the Assumption Cathedral, I'm meeting Father Thomas Ismoyo.
This area around 400 chairs every weekend masses. And
in terms of number, we only 3% out of total population. But in terms of our contribution to the society and the to the Catholic worldwide, I think we play a significant role.
Living across 17,000 islands, Indonesia has a population of 275 million, of which only around 3% are Catholic.
But we don't feel inferior with the numbers. Quality is more important than quantity.
Hello. The predominant religion is Islam, and right across from the cathedral stands one of the largest mosques in the world, Istiqlal. And while there are some reports of Christians being discriminated against in more rural parts of Indonesia, and there were some church attacks years ago, for the most part, there is peace between the religions.
In general, we live peacefully with our brothers and sisters, and we are grateful for that.
How have you obtained, generally speaking, that harmonious relationship between Christians and Muslims here in Indonesia, where in other parts of the world, or in Africa, parts of Europe now, they haven't been able to do that?
Because our founding fathers, who declared the independence of Indonesia, also maintain the unity, even though we are diverse in terms of language, tribes, and also religions.
It was Sukarno, the first president of Indonesia, who insisted that the national mosque be built right across from the cathedral, and not on the other side of the city as others were pushing for. Indonesian Cardinal Ignatius Suhario.
But the president, the first president, insisted the national mosque should be built near, face to face to the cathedral. That was meant to be very symbolical as the ideal of the Indonesian harmonious life.
The cardinal told me that the Islam here in Indonesia is different to some of the Islam coming out of, for example, the Middle East, which he says is due to the religions mixing here in society.
Some experts call it cultural Muslim. There's an immersion with the culture of Indonesia.
When Pope Francis arrives here at the cathedral, he will then visit the mosque across the street. But rather than crossing the road, he will use a newly government-constructed tunnel called the Tunnel of Tolerance, which links the grounds of the cathedral and the grounds of the mosque. Inside the Istiqlal Mosque, which holds 250,000 people, Pope Francis will meet the Grand Imam, Nasiruddin Umar.
I think this is the only one tolerance tunnel in the world.
What does the tunnel symbolize?
We are from the same grandfather, Abraham. We worship for the same God. Humanity is only one.
The country may have been able to achieve religious harmony, but prosperity for so many of its people, it has not. And as night falls over the capital, the ordinary people of Jakarta struggle to make a living.
I always feel very sorry to find that the people there, our brother, the same Indonesian, that they have to live such way of living. Very poor, very poor. Indonesia is very, what people say, religious countries. People are very religious. Everybody has religion.
Yes.
But we have to put a question mark, having religion and being religious. The corruption is so huge. Human trafficking is becoming more widespread.
Last-minute preparations are underway to welcome the Holy Father. And for the Catholic community here, this is a very exciting moment.
The coming of Pope, it's a really, you know, for me, very amazing. And, you know, the presence of Pope physically for us is, really something for us.
After Indonesia, Pope Francis will fly east to the country of Papua New Guinea. Papua New Guinea gained its independence from Australia in 1975 and today has a population of around 9 million. The country has mountains, dense rainforests, and rich biodiversity. And here in the sprawling capital, Port Moresby, in one of the city's busiest markets, I'm meeting Father Lawrence Irokiraj, a priest from India who has been here for 25 years.
So this is the middle of the market where you see people, a lot of people around.
So this is the evening time and people are buying and selling and
usually
hustling.
It's like a finishing of the day.
What's the Catholic community like here in Papua New Guinea?
when you ask Papua New Guinea, it's like, I would say, mostly like a village. They're very strong. They have very strong faith because they're very committed.
Father Lawrence explains that in a country where you have, for example, 800 languages, trying to bring about unity in Christianity is a difficult thing.
Because we have Christian, but we have different denominations. In the future, there is a problem that they will be divided among the denomination.
Such divisions among the denominations here, yeah, in the Christian church, yeah. Okay.
Cardinal John Ryabat is the Archbishop of Port Moresby and the most senior Catholic in the country.
The last smile from the sun to us.
Yeah, the last little kiss from the sun.
That's right, kiss.
As the sun gives us his last smile of the day, we sit down to talk about some of the challenges for the church here.
Your Eminence, you grew up here in Papua New Guinea.
Yes.
What are your memories of growing up as a Catholic in the country?
I was seeing my parents going to the priest, visiting the priest, and you know, you see a community coming together.
So you remember the sense of community?
Yeah, that's right. Okay, Papua New Guinea, or community here, they're community addicted.
Papua New Guinea is community addicted. And indeed, while here, we hear from many people the importance of community for the locals. But the problem is, much like the multiple denominations among Christians, the people's communities exist within various tribes and clans, which can cause division and, in some cases, vicious violence.
Back in the villages, there are some cultures that are very strong, and especially with payback system. We say payback system, but this is an eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth.
Really?
That kind of thing.
Even just 1 month ago, here in the Highlands, an estimated 40 people were massacred, others raped, and homes burnt down in a rural tribal dispute.
A massacre in the remote Papua New Guinea.
Even those bits of the jigsaw puzzle that we're able to put together from a great distance are horrifying.
So there are some places still that is very vicious and very strong.
Really?
Yeah, and that is up in the Highlands. Eh?
And what would happen in those tribal areas in the north?
You see, one of the dioceses that was very kind of, and good people and so on, and it was kind of, we thought that things were okay and so on. But now we are hearing of some, you know, really killing and so on like that. That is one of our dioceses.
While here, Pope Francis is scheduled to visit a local ministry that cares for street children. That is, children who can't afford to attend school and so roam the streets every day. The sisters offer them a free education.
And we try our best to teach them like A, B, C, D, how to spell their name, how to write, how to read.
The sisters here say what gives them the most joy is seeing the children leave the school after their studies, now with a better chance in life to have a brighter future.
It's giving me more joy seeing them growing each day in their life, so they feel also that they are special and they feel that they have a place and they are loved by somebody.
As the children in the school wait with excitement for the Pope, we are going west. Next, the Pope will fly to the small, young nation of Timor-Leste. This country only gained its full independence in 2002 after centuries of Portuguese colonization and a bloody occupation by Indonesia. The country is 97% Catholic, and in the capital, Dili, Pope Francis will meet with the country's president and Nobel Peace Prize winner, President José Ramos Horta.
From El Salvador.
With a police escort, the president is driving us to his residence where he has agreed to an interview ahead of the Pope's visit. And he tells me his country is not the first, but the second most Catholic nation in the world.
Because I'm told by the Vatican that Vatican City is the most Catholic in the world. I have some doubts, but because it's Vatican telling you, so I accept. So
we are number two. Vatican tell you, so you accept.
We are number two. Only because they are telling me that.
On a more serious note, President Ramos Horta witnessed firsthand the terror that was inflicted on this country during the Indonesian occupation of 1975 to 1999. His own siblings were murdered and he was exiled from the country. Even after the occupation ended and when he returned, there was an assassination attempt made on his life.
I didn't want any more Timorese to lose their life.
And throughout all of this, he saw the role the Catholic Church played.
For many, many years, the Church was the only institution that provided education and then provide shelter for poor people. And then increasingly over as the country evolved, particularly during the struggle for independence, well, if it were not for the Church sheltering people, saving lives, speaking out, I don't know whether we would be free today.
Really?
Yes.
Cardinal Virgilio do Carmo da Silva is Timor-Leste's first cardinal, and he too remembers that dark time in recent history.
During that moment, only the Church became the voice of the voiceless, the suffering, they were oppressed. As a people, all of us, we feel that wound that has been caused by Indonesians to almost all families.
And the Church is still working today to help those in Timor-Leste, where 40% of the people are below the poverty line. And sometimes, when a child is born with a disability or special need, they are abandoned. And one of the places Pope Francis will visit while he's here is the Irmas Alma School, a home for children with special needs who have been rejected by their families. Some of the children have autism, some Down syndrome, and others just mild physical disabilities. But what they all have in common now is that they are part of this family. Sister Anastasia Muti works here at the center.
We are living together with the kids. Kids come from every district in Timor-Leste. And then, yeah, we're living together with us like a family.
Because of how society in Timor-Leste views those with disabilities, these children have, in a way, been cast aside. Sister Gertrudis Baidi is the Mother Superior.
Why do they end up here? What are the circumstances that they come from?
Anak-anak yang tinggal dengan kami di sini.
Some of them have families who cannot care for them, but most have been abandoned. Some come to us straight from the hospital, and others from social welfare.
And walking around the building, you'll see that there's a lot of laughter. Finally, the Argentinian Pope will depart Dili, East Timor, and fly around 1,500 miles west to the island of Singapore. Known for its rapid development, diverse culture, and being a global financial hub, Singapore, with its modern skyscrapers, will be the most affluent stop on the Pope's trip, a far cry from the poverty that exists in the previous three countries. Often referred to as the Lion City, Singapore has a population of over 5 million and is predominantly Buddhist. The Catholic faith accounts for around 7% of the population. In the middle of the city is St. Francis Xavier Seminary, shaping the future priests of the country. Father Valerian Chong is the rector of the seminary.
Go and sell what you own and give the money to the poor.
How many seminarians do you have here at the moment?
Currently, we've got 22 seminarians for the Archdiocese of Singapore.
Are those numbers good? Are they healthy for Singapore?
It is good, but it's not replacement level. Because we have a number of priests who are retired, who passed on, the 20 will not replace. We can't. Yeah.
Really? So although the numbers are good, they're not at that level you need
yeah,
to replace the priests who are leaving.
At least in this current context, yeah.
Father Valerian tells me that as Singapore's economy and prosperity rises, the time people devote to their spiritual life is decreasing and sometimes even disappearing.
There's a growing number, which is almost more than a fifth, is actually those who profess no religion. What do you put that down to, that growth in atheism? I would reckon, I think it's also affluence, materialism. It is a place where you can get what you want, you know, that kind of thing. And it's materially, people have gotten distracted, I would say.
It's a big challenge for the church then, isn't it?
Extremely, extremely challenging to get at least the young people to grow and realize that there is more to just gaining the material things of life.
In the minority Catholic Church here, there are pockets of strong communities, like the one here at Divine Mercy Catholic Church. In the congregation this morning is Gerald Lee with his wife and young child. Passionate about his faith now, it wasn't always that way. And he remembers, too, getting caught up in Singapore's booming financial world.
I spent the early years of my career working in management consulting. And I think during those years, I did find myself becoming like the people who were around me, you know, very driven, type A, gravitating towards certain skills and certain values in life.
And what type of values were they?
I think prioritizing the career at all cost, to a fault.
Gerald Lee hopes that this visit of Pope Francis and the high publicity around it will trigger more young Singaporeans to re-examine their values.
What do you think this upcoming visit of Pope Francis will do for the church in Singapore and for Catholics across the country?
I think it's important for the Pope to remind society at large that there are more important things. Just from my interactions anecdotally with my friends in my circles, I think there actually is a sincere desire to search for more in life. I think that people are seeking. I think it's now the onus is on the church to go out and to find these people and to minister the love of Christ to them in a way that they can receive.
In Southeast Asia, Colm Flynn, EWTN News in Depth.
Our thanks to Colm Flynn and videographer Patrick Leonard for this preview of Pope Francis's journey. And believe it or not, there are more details to share. Colm's full version of his report is on the EWTN YouTube channel. Matthew, thank you for staying with us. That was such a beautiful piece.
Very profound.
Very. I was especially struck by the preview of Timor-Leste, this young country, about 97% Catholic. What stood out to you, especially from his interview with President José Manuel Ramos Horta?
Well, first, this is a Nobel Prize winner, a Peace Prize winner, who's driving them to an act of humility. But it's also a demonstration, I think, as he makes the point in his own interview with Colm, the role that the church plays in Asia. Mm-hmm. And the role that the church can play in Asia. Mm-hmm. And I think that fundamental role of peace, of bringing people together, that we saw that in the discussions about Indonesia, we saw it also in Singapore, that the church is there to stay.
Yeah, absolutely. And in the end, at the end of this very ambitious, longest trip Pope Francis has taken ever, what do you think will be the lasting impact of it?
Yeah, well, at the very start of our conversation, I used the word microcosm. Mm-hmm. One of the lasting parts of Francis' pontificate will be the images, the impressions that he leaves with people, just those small acts of mercy that we see. This trip is going to be filled with them. And one of the things that I think people will look back on is less than his words, but the fact that an 87-year-old, fairly frail pontiff mm-hmm. flew 20,000 miles to spend time with them to express that message of hope, of peace, of love. That's going to stay with them for a very long time, and I think will be one of the lasting legacies of Francis's vision for the church in Asia.
So the act of traveling is a message in and of itself.
It is.
Matthew, thank you so much.
Great to be with you.
Great to be with you. News headlines are next in the Week in Review. The latest on the first proposed presidential debate, the interview. Candidate Kamala Harris takes the first tough questions since her presidential nomination. And a lone Israeli hostage is rescued. His story ahead. News from the presidential campaign trail and an agreement about the first debate. tops the Week in Review. After some uncertainty and back and forth between the campaigns, it is confirmed. Candidates Donald Trump and Kamala Harris will face off on Tuesday, September 10th. Here's what we know. The 90-minute debate will be moderated by ABC News at the Constitution Center in Philadelphia. The candidates will stand behind lecterns. They will not be making opening statements, and they will not be allowed to bring notes. There will be no audience. And after some heated exchanges this past week, it was decided the microphones will be muted when candidates are not speaking. The rules are essentially the same as agreed to by the Biden campaign for the first debate before President Biden dropped out of the race.
I'm here today with a simple message for the American auto worker and for the American worker. Your long economic nightmare will very soon be over. It's going to be over.
This week, the candidates were on the trail. Donald Trump campaigned on Thursday in Battleground, Michigan, his third stop there in 9 days. Speaking to workers at Al Roe Steel Company, the focus of his talk was on the economy, inflation, and manufacturing, key issues for many voters. Trump also promised while campaigning later on Thursday in Wisconsin that if he wins, he wants to make IVF treatment free for families. He did not detail how he would fund it or how it would work. The Catholic Church teaches IVF is morally unacceptable because it separates the marriage act from procreation and establishes the domination of technology over human life. That as Kamala Harris took a two-day bus trip with running mate Tim Walz, touring Southeast Georgia, stopping in restaurants, marketplaces, and other small businesses to chat with voters. Georgia is another key swing state. Though this rural part of the state typically votes Republican, the Democratic ticket is making an effort to appeal to small-town America with hopes of attracting enough voters to cut into past Republican advantage. During that bus trip, Harris and Walz sat down for their first major media interview since being tapped to head the Democratic ticket. Some critics wondering why the vice president took so long to take journalist questions. Among many topics, she spoke about a future she sees for America. You
mentioned, I am so proud to be running with Tim Walz for president of the United States and to bring America what I believe the American people deserve, which is a new way forward and turn the page on the last decade of what I believe has been contrary to where the spirit of our country really lies.
But the last decade, of course, the last 3.5 years has been part of your administration.
I'm talking about an era that started about a decade ago where there is some suggestion, warped, I believe it to be, that the measure of the strength of a leader is based on who you beat down, instead of where I believe most Americans are, which is to believe that the true measure of the strength of a leader is based on who you lift up.
Harris added, as much as any other detail or issue that could be discussed in this election, that tone and attitude towards others is what is at stake. A new Gallup poll this month shows Americans' enthusiasm for voting has soared. The poll was conducted August 1st through 20th before the Democratic National Convention, but after President Joe Biden ended his reelection bid. About 7 in 10 Americans, a record high 69%, said they are more enthusiastic than usual about voting compared to previous elections. Gallup says Democrats and Democratic-leaning independents were largely behind the big numbers. How does that translate into Catholic voters? EWTN News wanted to find out. In partnership with Real Clear Opinion Research, our own election poll is now out in the field, centered on what Catholic voters think. The results next week here on EWTN News in Depth, as well as commentary and analysis on EWTN News Nightly, Catholic News Agency, and the National Catholic Register. The FBI says the gunman who attempted to take former President Trump's life at a campaign rally last month saw the event as a target of opportunity. This week, investigators shared that and other new details related to the investigation. Investigators found 20-year-old Thomas Matthew Crooks made extensive attack planning before firing 8 shots at Trump on July 13th. He searched for campaign events for both Trump and President Biden and later honed in on the former president's appearance in Butler, Pennsylvania, near his home after it was announced. His interest in both major political parties has stumped the FBI's efforts to find a clear motive and why Trump was ultimately targeted. The investigation, which has included almost 1,000 interviews and extensive analysis on the gunman's search history, is ongoing. An important visit to China this week for U.S. National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan, the first visit there by a White House security advisor in 8 years. The stated purpose of the three-day visit was to keep communications open in a relationship between two superpowers, which has become increasingly tense in recent years. In meetings with Chinese President Xi Jinping, China's foreign minister, and top military generals, both governments expressed eagerness to keep relations on an even keel ahead of a change in the U.S. presidency in January. Both sides have been at odds over a trade war dating back to the Trump administration, global security, industrial policy, and serious escalation of clashes between China and the Philippines in the South China Sea. Here's analyst Gordon Chang, author of The Coming Collapse of China.
This is going to get worse. When China saber rattles with Taiwan, that's huffing and puffing, because I don't think the Chinese military want to take on that island republic. But on the Philippines, they see it as a weakling. They see it as a big political win and a quick win without casualties. And so they're going to do things which make things even worse. They're going to go too far. We have an obligation to defend the Philippines. This is really serious.
At the conclusion of the meetings, the two countries agreed to a phone call between Xi and Biden in the coming weeks, with a suggestion the two could meet in person at the Asia-Pacific Economic Summit this fall in Peru. Diplomatic talks continue this week in an effort to get Israel and Hamas to agree to details of a ceasefire and hostage release. While there has not been a breakthrough in the talks, U.S. officials say they are encouraged the talks continue and that regional escalation with Hezbollah and Iran has so far been prevented. Negotiators said the main issues in talks this week were the particulars and details of how to exchange hostages held by Hamas for Palestinians currently held in Israeli prisons. And this one ray of hope, friends, family and staff warmly applauded Israeli hostage Quaid Farhar Khan al-Qadi upon his release from a medical center. Israeli forces found the 52-year-old in Hamas's extensive tunnels on Tuesday, the first hostage to be found alive in the underground network. A member of Israel's Bedouin Arab minority, al-Qadi was captured by Hamas forces on October 7th while working as a guard at a packing plant. After more than 10 months in captivity, al-Qadi was emaciated, but joyful to be reunited with his family. One of his brothers said it's like he's come back to life. According to Israel, more than 100 hostages remain in Gaza. The Diocese of Avila in Spain reported this week the body of St. Teresa of Avila remains incorrupt almost five centuries after her death. The Spanish mystic's tomb was opened this week so Italian doctors and scientists can begin to study her relics. They found her relics in the same incorrupt condition they were in the last time her tomb was opened in 1914, 110 years ago. The Diocese of Avila says the process of reaching the silver coffin containing the doctor of the church's body was complicated, but eventually her silver tomb was opened in the presence of a scientific medical team and members of the ecclesiastical court. Scholars were struck by its magnificent state of preservation and robustness. St. Teresa of Avila is the founder of the Order of Discalced Carmelites, a Spanish mystic and the first woman doctor of the church, who died in 1582. Our final story today when EWTN News in Depth returns right after this.
Glorious shot up the Champs-Élysées, then up to triumph in the distance. Excitement there.
A spectacular scene as athletes in Paris prepare for the opening of the Paralympic Games. A Catholic perspective on celebrating the special example these athletes can set for us all. The Paralympic Games opened in Paris this week, gathering top athletes with a range of disabilities from around the world. From modest beginnings, the Games have become one of the largest sports competitions in the world, and this year's Games will be bigger than ever. 4,400 Paralympians paraded down the iconic Champs-Élysées during Wednesday's opening ceremony. A record number of spectators are expected to tune into the event. And for the first time ever, there will be live coverage of all 22 sports. Charlene Cotra, executive director of the National Catholic Partnership on Disability, says the Games not only highlight the talents of these athletes, but bring viewers a deeper awareness of devices and technology that make every part of society, from sports competitions to Sunday Mass, more accessible for all.
This is a whole level of raising awareness to the rest of us sometimes. That's like I said, to all the viewers that are seeing things through new eyes, in a sense, that don't realize some of the adaptations or modifications that are made for an athlete in particular. And I guess what I say is that you kind of can extrapolate that to say, not only in sports, but in everyday life, these same assisted technologies are extremely beneficial. And I would say as church, there are certainly many of them that also can be looked at as implemented in church properties and in church programming. But, you know, from assisted listening devices to obviously wheelchair access, on and on.
The Summer Paralympics will continue through September 8th. The Games will come to Los Angeles with the Olympics in the summer of 2028. And that does it for this edition of EWTN News in Depth. I'm Catherine Hadro. Next week, the results of our EWTN News political poll, looking at the Catholic vote in this year's presidential election. Until we see you again for that same time next week, God bless.